Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the fight over the evidence that launched a war with Iraq has hit the fan. Tony Blair stands by the claim that there was an attempt by Iraq to purchase uranium from Niger. But U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who investigated that claim, says it doesn't hold water and that he told the vice president's office as much almost a year before the president's State of the Union speech. The White House conceded that the report should not have been referenced in the president's speech, but now says that the CIA gave the address a green light, and CIA Director George Tenet agrees. Democrats and some Republicans are calling for a full investigation of the honesty and accuracy of the case that was made for war. The administration pushed back yesterday and today, with Colin Powell calling the bad intelligence story overwrought, overblown, and overdrawn. Tonight, On Point, the battle over the evidence that took the nation to war. Who knew what, when they knew it, and what it matters now. We begin in Washington, where the media is scrambling to make sense of conflicting claims about key evidence offered in the case for war. This morning, Walter Pincus, who covers security affairs for The Washington Post, reported that in September last year, the CIA tried to get the British government to back off claims that Iraq had sought to buy uranium for a nuclear weapons program from Niger. I asked him how the African uranium claim made it into the president's January State of the Union speech if the CIA was already refuting the report in September.
As Condoleezza Rice tried to explain today in her press conference, changes were made in the original approach the White House wanted to take. The White House, in discussions before there was even a draft, wanted to put in Niger and wanted to say that the amount, which is something like 500 tons for 2 years, wasn't true. They didn't believe it, and they wanted that taken out. And it was switched to attempting to buy uranium in Africa.
So who wanted that taken out? The CIA?
The CIA got that taken out.
Mm-hmm. The specific Niger 500 tons of yellow cake,
right,
assertion.
As had been done in December, when it originally was put forward publicly by the State Department in a fact sheet. And the next day, when that information went out to the Post around the world, Niger was gone, and it was the same phrase, attempting to buy uranium oxide in Africa. And this was information that had been circulating for some years, not just about Niger, but also in the case of the Congo and Somalia. But the information was so sketchy, the CIA was nervous about it.
And was the CIA concerned that the Niger claim was based on what turned out to be bogus documents?
They didn't have the document, but they were concerned about some of the people named in the documents. And you have to remember, by that time, they had already sent retired Ambassador Joe Wilson to Niger. He had talked to some of the principals involved in the documents, and they had denied it. Then he had also come back and said, under the system in Niger, it would have been almost impossible.
But the broader assertion that Iraq was seeking to buy uranium in Africa ended up in the President's State of the Union address. On what basis, on what evidence or report?
It ended up on the report of the British, and it's attributed to the British. What's interesting about that speech is on seven different occasions, the president referred to U.S. intelligence being the source of information that he, in some cases, is disclosing for the first time. This is the only sentence, this is the only intelligence fact attributed to the British. And it's done that way because the CIA was uncomfortable with its information, and the British had assured them that they had a different source and a different country giving them the information, and they stood by it.
So, Walter Pincus, that means that the president couldn't lean on the CIA. They were saying don't. He leaned instead on British reports. But as you report,
these British intelligence had not been made independently available to the United States, or had not been made fully available to the U.S. government, and as I had read you, have not been made available even today. Is that right?
That's the way it's described to me, both from British and American sources.
Now, why? Here are the closest of allies. This issue has become of great moment. Here we are months into the controversy, and the British would not be willing to share the intelligence or the source of the intelligence. Is that credible?
Well, I think to some degree you have to take it at what they said. This is one fact that the president used to support a broader issue of does he have weapons of mass destruction, but it comes in the middle of a big debate as to whether the policymakers, including the president, exaggerated some of the information intelligence had been gathered in order to make their case. And the State of the Union speech fit into that category. Mm-hmm. It led into Secretary of State Colin Powell's speech at the UN on the 5th of February, which really was a setup to our decision to go ahead and drop inspections and go to war.
Both President Bush and Condoleezza Rice said today in Africa that the CIA had given full clearance to that State of the Union speech, wherein the president asserts this African uranium connection, even though the CIA itself had argued against that connection. Why would the CIA give its blessing to an assertion that it was not prepared to support?
Because it's attached to the British.
Mm-hmm.
The changes were made that the CIA wanted, and the final change was the White House decision to attach it to the British, which in effect left the British information as the support for that fact.
And the CIA could wash its hands of that assertion.
The CIA could, and you have to remember Colin Powell also did not object to it, although 8 days later he didn't carry the same information in his speech. And he and Condoleezza Rice today both said he dropped it because his analysts didn't believe it.
Walter Pincus, you write that as this controversy escalates, the interests of the U.S. government and the British government have begun to diverge. How so?
There is some sense that the U.S. position that the information hasn't been proven out yet is being challenged by Tony Blair. He is in deeper trouble, I would say, politically than the president right now.
So he's insisting on the African uranium connection to Iraq.
Right.
And as the Bush administration distances itself from that assertion, it, in a sense, undercuts Tony Blair's.
It does to a degree, but if you read Condoleezza Rice today closely, she suddenly turns around and makes the point that it's not been proven false, that it's only in the Niger case the documents are questionable. Mm-hmm. And that whether Iraq tried to buy it in the other two countries still hasn't been proven false. Now you've got to prove a negative. But I think she was trying to give a little support to Tony Blair today, too.
Walter, you've watched the dynamics of Washington for a long time. The administration has come out all guns blazing today on this issue. Do you think they are sort of shooting their way out of this corner, or are they stuck with this controversy in their laps?
Well, I think there's another dynamic to that, and that is as long as no weapons of mass destruction are found, this thing will continue to bubble along. And particularly as long as Saddam Hussein is not found dead or alive, and the opposition seems to continue, and American soldiers are wounded or killed, people will then look back, and this will become more important. The United States public is almost willing to stand being told anything if that policy becomes successful. But beware if a policy fails, because then there is a lot of looking back.
And right now, the weapons have not been found, and American soldiers are dying in Iraq.
Right.
Walter Pincus, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Walter Pincus covers national security affairs for The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier from Washington.
I gave a speech to the nation that was cleared by the intelligence services. And it was a speech that detailed to the American people the dangers posed by the Saddam Hussein regime.
That was President Bush earlier today in Uganda. Tonight, the battle over intelligence used to justify war with Iraq is raging in Washington. In this hour, we look at the claims and counterclaims. Was the United States taken honestly to war? Was the president making the strongest possible case to address an urgent security threat? Or was he deliberately exaggerating? Was he leading or lying. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is David Korn, Washington editor for The Nation magazine. Good evening and welcome, David Korn.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Good to have you. David Korn, you have made some very rough assertions yourself about what's going on with the Bush administration and truth and evidence and intelligence in the advance of war with Iraq. I guess the bottom line, and I'm looking here at one of your columns from this week, two simple words. You say Bush lied. We're going to get an opposing view in a few minutes, but make your case. What went on with the evidence and with what import?
Okay, well, I think the Niger thing is just, you know, a very small piece of this, not even the biggest piece. You can look at, you know, I'll keep it simple. Let's start with the two basic premises that Bush put forward as a reason to go to war.
Okay.
They were, one, that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, actually possessed them, not programs, not seeking them, but had them in his midst. And two, that at any moment he could hand them over to anti-American terrorists like al-Qaeda, who he was, as Bush said in a November 7th press conference, he was dealing with, his word, dealing. Saddam is dealing with al-Qaeda, who are known enemies to America and have sworn to do damage to us, and Saddam Hussein had these weapons.
And from that pair of assertions, you get the imminent threat.
Yes. Without that, you don't have the imminent threat. Now, there are a lot of reasons, perhaps, to go to war, strategic balance reasons, liberating the poor, repressed people of Iraq, all sorts of things, that people have been talking about for years prior to 9/11, advocates for war with Iraq. Now, what Bush did was he made the case that Saddam Hussein was a direct threat, again, his words, a direct threat today to the American public. And that's why we could not wait. We cannot afford to wait 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months to do any more inspections, any more intrusive, even more robust, more aggressive, more assertive inspections that had already been underway.
So, David Korn, then, are you saying that WMD have not been found, the president was necessarily lying? That means did not have them?
I'm saying, regardless of what was found, he said two statements. Saddam Hussein's dealing with al-Qaeda, and he does possess weapons of mass destruction. March 17th, the sort of get-out-of-dodge speech that he gave to Saddam Hussein 48 hours or we come in. In that speech, he said, our intelligence shows there is no doubt, his words, no doubt that Saddam Hussein possesses weapons of mass destruction. Now, not in the past, but now. Now, what we know after the fact, not only that we haven't found them, which, shows you something.
Something, not everything necessarily, but something.
But something, but there's an internal review that's been going on at the CIA and by the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee. And the preliminary findings that have been announced by these people conducting this review, including by Richard Kerr, who is the former deputy director of the CIA, who's doing this internal review at the CIA, is that all the intelligence had caveats and qualifiers to them. Now, that means that there was doubt. That means that it wasn't no doubt. That means at best, here are the indications that he might have weapons of mass destruction, but it wasn't as if there was no doubt. When Bush says to the public, there is no doubt that he possesses this stuff, according to our intelligence, that is a lie.
Well, but is it a lie or is it rhetorical streamlining to lead a nation?
I take the president at the word. If he says there's no doubt, I know what no doubt means. That means that there's no doubt. That means you have guaranteed for certain evidence that, that would convince a reasonable person, and the intelligence agencies themselves are saying, well, there are caveats and qualifiers, we don't have hard evidence.
But you know that for a decade, many nations had been saying that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Just months before the U.S. went in, the United Nations Security Council said Iraq was in material breach.
Well, that's different. They said they were in material breach by not giving in, consenting, going along with the inspection process. Indeed, they were a material breach. They were a material breach before Resolution 1441. But there are a lot of ways to be in breach without actually possessing weapons. Now, the question is, if they're a material breach, you can come up with all sorts of different types of punishment. War might be one of them. But that wasn't the reason we went to war. It was because there was an imminent threat, a direct threat. Now, Bush could have argued, these guys are not playing with the UN the way they should be. They're not letting the inspectors do everything that the inspectors want to do, and therefore we have to invade.
But that wasn't it. He said imminent threat. We've got 10 seconds here. if indeed it was a lie, what does it matter, David Korn?
Well, I think it matters. It gets to the foundation of democracy. If, you know, if a president's going to take us to war and isn't telling us the truth. And the other lie is the business about Saddam Hussein having operational links to al-Qaeda.
Hold off on that one. We're going to hear another view in just a moment. We're talking tonight about the battle over the evidence that took the nation to war with Iraq. Was the United States taken honestly to war with Iraq? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the battle over intelligence reports that were used to make the case for war with Iraq. Yesterday, while traveling in South Africa with the President, Secretary of State Colin Powell responded to the growing controversy.
To think that somehow we went out of our way to insert this single sentence into the State of the Union address for the purpose of deceiving and misleading the American people is an overdrawn, overblown, overwrought conclusion.
Secretary of State Colin Powell yesterday in Pretoria, South Africa, looking back, was the United States justified in going to war against Iraq? Have the American people been boldly defended or bamboozled? Was the president leading or lying? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been speaking with David Korn, Washington editor for The Nation magazine. Joining me now from Washington is Clifford May, president of Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a think tank on terrorism created in response to 9/11. He also served as director of communications for the Republican National Committee from 1997 to 2001. Good evening and welcome, Clifford May.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you very much for joining us. Clifford May, you say it's not President Bush who's lying, it's the president's critics who are lying. It's the lead sentence of your recent essay on this. Make your case.
Right. Well, the whole brouhaha is over what President Bush said in a State of the Union speech, and that was 100% accurate. And what happened is, as this was brewing, I went back and looked up what he actually said. He said the British government had learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought uranium from Africa. He didn't say anything about Saddam Hussein actually acquiring uranium from Niger in this one case.
Then why is the White House falling over itself this week to apologize and say that was an error?
I can't really tell you that, but let's talk about what we really do know. And that is that not only were the British saying at the time, which is accurate, but the British continue to say it, and they say it was based on their own intelligence.
Well, Blair continues to say it, but a parliamentary committee has said this week this looks like bull, Prime Minister.
Let's understand something. Saddam Hussein had a nuclear weapons program. There's no question about that. It was bombed by the Israelis in 1981, and at the end of the Gulf War in 1991, we found out that Saddam Hussein was further along in this nuclear weapons program than we had believed.
But had is past tense, so Okay. Exactly what do you mean?
Well, I also mean that during the 1990s, there were reports from the International Atomic Energy Commission, among others, that he still had it. If he didn't have it, at what point did he get rid of it? I don't think he did. He may have had it under wraps because he couldn't continue with it while the heat was on. Maybe that's why, for example, that Iraqi scientist buried the nuclear centrifuge in his backyard. But he was trying. But the idea that he was trying to acquire uranium, not just from Niger, but also from Gabon or from Namibia or from Serbia, where there were widespread reports of that, Russia as well. This was very widely known. If you have a nuclear weapons program,
well, maybe widely known, but this week the White House acknowledged that this statement in the State of the Union address, they said, should not have been there. They acknowledged that it was linked to forged documents.
No, yes, they did.
Let me suggest. It's come to light that the document's forgery was known a year before the war. I mean, I'm just throwing out what's tumbled out this week and looking for your response.
I'm telling you that what President Bush said was absolutely accurate about, because what he said was that Saddam, according to the British, are seeking uranium in Africa. The forged document you talked about had to do with whether or not Saddam Hussein not just sought it, but had actually obtained it from Niger.
But it's Ari Fleischer, the president's spokesman, who made the link this week between those forged documents and the State of the Union speech. I mean, the White House isn't ducking the linkage.
I'm sorry, but I'm telling you, I can't explain what Ari Fleischer said as he's leaving the White House. I am saying to you, and I don't think there's going to be any question about this, that Bush said that according to British intelligence, Saddam Hussein was seeking uranium in Africa. That is true. The British believed it. Tony Blair continues to believe it. Many other people have reported that Saddam Hussein was seeking it there and in many other countries. By the way, David Corn talks about weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
We're not simply talking about nuclear weapons when we talk about weapons of mass destruction.
Of course not.
We're talking about chemical weapons.
Biological, neither of which have been found in Iraq.
Excuse me, Tom. Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons. We know that. We know that because he used them and killed thousands of his own people with them.
Again, that's past tense. You're talking 10 years ago. I'm not saying
exactly.
He didn't, but that they have not been found. That's all.
If you're making the allegation that Saddam Hussein got rid of all his chemical weapons, got rid of all his biological weapons, closed down his nuclear weapons program, then he would not have been in material breach. He wouldn't have been in violation.
I don't make any allegation. We're just trying to explore here. But the bottom line to you, Clifford May, is that there was no pattern of exaggeration or deceit here, that the administration was absolutely straight up with the American people and the world in advance of war with Iraq. Is that your position?
My position is that the case for going to war with Saddam Hussein was not based on whether or not yellow cake uranium came from Niger to Baghdad. The case was made on the basis that Saddam Hussein had been a butcher of his own people and there were humanitarian interests as we now have in Liberia, that he was a threat to us, that post 9/11, when you have the matrix of rogue dictators who declare themselves to be our enemies, who conspire with terrorists, as Saddam Hussein did, and who have weapons of mass destruction programs that they will not surrender, as he would not, and will not comply with the agreements they made, as Saddam did not at the end of 1901 in response to the ceasefire, then you have a problem that you need to do something about. I am glad Saddam Hussein was toppled. I think most Americans are. The idea that we should wait until we have proof that even Johnny Cochran could support in a court of law doesn't make any sense to me, and I don't think it's going to make sense to most Americans. Are we really making the case that we should have left Saddam Hussein in power?
Clifford May, let's hold it right there. I want to bring David Corn in here, and we'll come right back to you. David Corn, your reply.
I don't even know where to begin with all Cliff's spin. To begin with, let's start with Ari Fleischer and the White House. Okay? Cliff said something that Ari Fleischer said when he was leaving the White House shouldn't be taken seriously. To begin with, it wasn't when he was leaving the White House. It was a White House press conference, and he was asked whether the president's statement was based on the Niger case. The statement that Cliff keeps saying is
true.
Ari Fleischer at the White House was asked whether it was based on the Niger case, and he says, and I quote directly from the transcript, you can go to the website and look this up, the president's statement was based on the predicate of the yellow cake from Niger. The president made a broad statement, but that broader statement was based and predicated on the yellow cake from Niger.
So we've got Ari Fleischer saying that, but you have to concede. I mean, there is this the speech.
So was the statement wrong?
Yeah.
And he says, that's what we've acknowledged. This is the White House saying the statement was wrong. Now, Cliff can go defend it, but the White House has said that it was based on the case of Niger and that it was wrong.
Well, there is ambiguity here. I don't want to get trapped in it. On the one hand, they did change the language. I mean, this is what everybody's saying today, Condoleezza Rice and the rest, that it was changed to make it less specific. On the other hand, it's also true, Ari Fleischer said this came out of the Niger accusation. But what about the broader picture? Clifford May says, look, you had the matrix here that was a menace to the United States. It had to be addressed.
You know, yes, there was a menace, there was a problem here. But Cliff is out there saying, listen, the IAEA said that there was a nuclear weapons program in Iraq. Well, you know what? That's not what they said. I'll quote to you directly from the 1998 report, because facts do matter.
Yes, they do.
And they do. And they said in 1998, there are no indications that Iraq has achieved its program's goal of producing nuclear weapons. And it said, the IAEA, that its own inspectors had, quote, taken actions to destroy, remove, and render harmless the known components of that program. So you cannot quote the IAEA, as Cliff just did, to suggest there was an operational program that was close to producing something that would be a direct threat to the United States. Now, sure, Saddam Hussein is interested in nuclear weapons and is interested in weapons of mass destruction, but that's different than possessing them. And indeed,
no,
the fact
said
that stuff was buried for 12 years in someone's front yard only goes to show that maintaining pressure on him was working. And Cliff insults 60% of America and much of the rest of the world when he poses a false dichotomy and says that the only option to dealing with Saddam Hussein was war or doing nothing. Many people wanted to give inspections, some of them quite intrusive, some quite assertive, before going to war. It was the president who said we can't afford to do this because he has weapons now, not weapons programs, and was dealing with Al Qaeda. When again, even the CIA now is saying there's no evidence that there were operational links. So those are the reasons. The facts are against them, and you can spin all you like.
Got it. We've got it, David Cronin. Clifford, may let me put it to you then. We understand. We've got it fully. You think this war was a wise thing to do? Many people do.
Yeah.
And it succeeded in toppling Hussein. The aftermath, who knows here?
Yeah.
But given that, do you see any light at a factual level between the statements of the administration over all these months and the actual facts on the ground? Was there exaggeration here, even if in a cause that you might support?
Only when those facts are misrepresented, as I'm afraid my friend David Corn does.
Now, let's not go back to he quoted Ari Fleischer quite appropriately.
If he wants to attack Ari Fleischer, that's fine. Attack Ari Fleischer. Say Ari Fleischer should be fired. I am telling you, and that it is obvious that the president said nothing untrue, and the president is being called a liar by people like David Corn, and that's wrong, because the president has said nothing untrue to make his case. The president never claimed, as David is suggesting, that Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons. Nobody thought that. They thought he might be close.
Well, David is suggesting the president said that he had he possessed weapons of mass destruction.
Yes,
he's pointing out they haven't been found. He's pointing out they haven't been found. And secondly,
He did possess those. He did have those programs, and he refused to surrender those programs as he was obligated to do.
But the point is they simply haven't been found at this point. And secondly,
Saddam Hussein hasn't been found. That doesn't mean Saddam Hussein doesn't exist.
Oh, give me a break.
Well, and secondly, there was the issue of the connection between Saddam Hussein and Al Qaeda, which is the second major point that David Cohen was saying is untrue.
No, there are connections between Al Qaeda and between Saddam Hussein. And by the way, what do you think Al Qaeda is out there saying that Saddam Hussein should be supported by jihadist terrorists who should go to Iraq and fight the Americans? There are connections.
Well, now that the Americans are there up to their neck,
such as Hamas, there is no question that Saddam was connected to Hamas and other terrorists. I'm not saying that there were operational links, that they did joint exercises. I'm saying they had a relationship. And I think it would be possible at any point for Saddam Hussein, who liked to take care of his enemies in very malevolent ways, to say, okay, I am going to give this biological weapon to Al-Qaeda as long as my hands are off it, or I'm going to give this chemical weapon, or if he built it, a dirty bomb or some kind of nuclear weapon.
And
if you want to sit back and wait and see if he does that, and then say, okay, only after the crime we will do something about it. I understand that point of view, but I disagree with it.
You know, the CIA put out a report October 8th, its own analyst, that said that they had no reason to believe that Saddam Hussein had any interest in attacking the U.S. unless he was put in a corner and attacked first. Now, they may be wrong, they may not be wrong, but you can't, but again, you know, you could spin out all sorts of nightmare scenarios and say, we, you know, this could happen, that could happen, and we have to go to war to prevent that.
David Corn, Clifford May, stand by. I want to invite our callers in here. There are a lot of them who want to join this conversation. Joe is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm under the understanding that Paul Wolfowitz gave an interview with Vanity Fair in which he said that the primary motivation for going to war wasn't weapons of mass destruction at all, but it was to get our troops out of Saudi Arabia. And I don't see much being made of that interview, either by the press or by, it seems to have just been dropped, and I'm wondering if your guests will comment on
it. Yeah, well, it was quoted pretty widely in the week that it came out. David Corn?
Well, he said that the reason they led with the weapons of mass destruction argument was because it was something that everyone in the bureaucracy could agree with, which made it sound like it wasn't, you know, done on the basis of merit, but on the basis of what would work politically. He did thought that the troops should be removed from Saudi Arabia and that this would be a good benefit of going to war in Iraq.
And Tom, I urge people
Clifford
to actually,
May, please.
I urge people to actually read that interview in Vanity Fair. It's overall a good interview.
Yep.
Because you talk about no connections between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden.
Well, that's David Korn's suggestion.
I understand. Osama bin Laden said that the two principal reasons for 9/11 were, one, U.S. troops on holy Saudi soil. He said that was a blasphemy that couldn't be allowed. Two, the sanctions that the U.S. had imposed on Iraq that were killing the Iraqi people, they must be lifted. Yes, Wolfowitz said it would be good for us to get our troops out of Saudi Arabia. It's causing the Muslim world doesn't like it. Maybe I don't think that's fair, but they don't. And it's a grievance, and it's hard for us, too. You have troops there who can't wear a cross on the streets of downtown Riyadh. You have women who can't go out and drive a car. That would be a good thing. Why were the troops in Saudi Arabia? To protect the Saudis from Saudi Saddam Hussein, who had also attempted to kill an American president. David says he had nothing against us. That's nonsense. He had sworn revenge.
I never said that.
But us as our enemy. You said, oh, the CIA thought he wouldn't do anything to us.
The CIA said, you can look it up. It's on many websites. The CIA came up with
the conclusion. CIA. Don't
that
criticize
was their
the president.
Cliff.
But Clifford May, I wonder if at certain points here, along the lines of our caller Joe's question, are you being holier than the Pope here? I ask it with respect.
What I see here is a politically motivated campaign. That's why the DNC is doing an ad on this in which they'll misrepresent the quote by taking out the fact that he attributed the intelligence to the British. There'll be another ad done by MoveOn.org. I see this as a politically motivated campaign. I know what it's aiming to do. It's aiming to cut Bush's numbers and nothing else. And I'm sorry to see it on an issue as important as this, where there should be some bipartisan consensus or at least debate from politics.
There's a lot of bipartisan consensus. You have the Republicans saying that they're investigating the pre-war intelligence and the pre-war assertions of the Bush administration on weapons of mass destruction. You have Dick Lugar, the Republican chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, coming back and saying the president hasn't told the public the truth about what it's going to take to get things done in Iraq. These are Republicans who are concerned about this, too. There is some bipartisanship going on.
Let me just give the Paul Wolfowitz quote from the Vanity Fair article that our caller Joe referred to was this. He said, "For bureaucratic reasons, we settled on one issue, WMD, because it was the one reason everyone could agree on." Now, you can interpret that lots of ways, but it does suggest there were a halo of issues around that issue.
Exactly. I know exactly what that meant because I was in communication with the White House on this. I was making the case that the human rights issues should be more predominant in this argument because Saddam Hussein was a butcher of a kind Charles Taylor of Liberia cannot even ever imagine being.
Clifford May, let me get one more call in here. Right. Dave is calling from Sterling, Massachusetts. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Tom.
Sure.
I want to start by just saying I am neither declared Democrat or Republican.
Okay.
And I think that the Democrats are just totally blown out of proportion.
Mm-hmm.
And just because they haven't been found yet doesn't – I mean, I think it's
– They haven't been found. You mean that the weapons of mass destruction, so-called, have not been found?
Right. And that jumping on this bandwagon just try to make news, and I think it's totally politically motivated. And any Democrat – I heard my own congressman today in Massachusetts, McGovern – get on that bandwagon, the day they're found, it's going to be their political doom, and they'll be eating a lot of crow. And I think a lot of people get aggravated with this kind of grandstanding.
Mm-hmm. You think there's going to be egg on the faces of the Democratic critics of the president? Let me ask you, Dave, while I've got you on the line, do you think that the president exaggerated at all in order to get the country to do what he thought was the right thing?
Based on what I've heard, I don't think so. I mean, I trust Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, and their explanation sounds fine to me. I think it is ludicrous to believe that Bush is deliberately, this one statement is going, this is the reason that he's calling the president a liar. I think it is. You got to have a little bit better proof than what I've seen so far.
Okay, we've got it. Dave, thank you very much for your call. David Korn, Democrats going to end up with egg on their faces when WMD come pouring up out of a bunker somewhere?
Well, that's a pretty big if. There was a story in the New York Times today that British officials are now saying that they don't believe they will find WMDs in Iraq. I mean, is the caller going to, support the inverse of his argument, that if they're not found, there should be egg on the face of the White House? What I'm saying is, regardless of whether they're found or not, if you look at the pre-war statements, and I haven't made a big deal of the Niger case, I think it's kind of a more on the minor level, but if you look at other Bush statements and other Bush administration statements from the year before the war, you have plenty and plenty of exaggeration that was done for political purposes. Now, Clifford,
we'll talk about it some more. We're going to take a break. David Korn, Clifford May, please stand by. We're looking at the battle over the evidence that took the nation to war with Iraq. Did the Bush administration cross a line here, or is the furious criticism this week, in Colin Powell's words, overwrought, overblown, and overdrawn? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the battle over the evidence that took the nation to war with Iraq. It has exploded in Washington this week and around the world. London's having a huge Donnybrook over it. My guests tonight are Clifford May. He's president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a think tank on terrorism created in response to 9/11. He writes a weekly column distributed by the Scripps Howard News Service. He was director of communications for the Republican National Committee from 1997 to 2001. And David Korn, Washington editor for The Nation magazine. You can join the conversation as well. Was the United States taken honestly to war with Iraq? Did the president make the strongest possible case to address an urgent security threat? Or did he exaggerate? Did he lead or lie? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Terry's calling from Meadville, Pennsylvania. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great, thanks. Great, thanks.
Just one comment and then a question.
Yeah.
Just with regard to Clifford May's point, I think it's an insult to many of us to say that this is simply politically motivated. I've written letters to all of my representatives. I'm very concerned that either there was faulty intelligence or misuse of the intelligence that existed, and I think many Americans feel that way. With regards to the question, I just wondered if either of your guests had any sense of or if you've heard anything about the forged documents in the Niger uranium case.
Right.
Who might have forged those documents? Where might they have come from? And who might have been motivated to create these documents in the first place? Seems to me a question that has not been asked.
That is a great question, and I don't know the answer, though. It's floated around in the back of my mind, and I've never managed to pin it down. But let's go to that, and thank you for your call. Clifford May, any idea? These were documents, letters that indicated that yellow cake uranium was the subject of a potential transaction between Niger and Iraq. They were determined to be forgeries.
Yeah.
Who would have had an interest, or who would have created such forgeries in the first place?
It's a good question. When you're dealing in these matters, it's a three-dimensional chess game. Who knows who would have been? By the way, it could have been that there was some truth to the possibility that some kind of transaction was being worked out, and that as a matter of disinformation, bad evidence was put in. Keep in mind, it was Vice President Cheney who had doubts about this whole Niger story, and he went to the CIA and said, "You've got to verify this. You've got to see if you can find out what happened." I'll tell you what I don't understand at all is why the CIA didn't do it themselves. Why instead they went to the State Department, who sent a retired ambassador,
Ambassador Joseph Wilson, former
Joseph
ambassador
Wilson,
to Gabon,
who has no investigative experience, who works for a pro-Saudi outfit, who was opposed to the war, and who sat around Niger for 8 days drinking tea, as he puts it, and asking and doing interviews. Does anybody think if he got an interview with somebody who had been involved in trying to arrange a transaction of a yellow cake to Iraq, he would sit there and have tea and say to Ambassador Wilson, "Well, as a matter of fact, yes, I got paid $250,000 for facilitating this."
Well, I mean, this wasn't a complete babe in the woods. He was a career Foreign Service man who had been in Africa a lot. His op-ed piece in the New York Times last weekend kind of turbocharged this whole conversation.
I also say what I argue today, frankly, is that he is not a disinterested civil servant. He was not a trained investigator, as a CIA agent would be. And I think his background should have been given by the New York Times and others who are quoting him.
But there's an element, excuse me one second, please. Clifford May, this element of holier than the Pope comes back here. I mean, the CIA appears to have accepted Ambassador Wilson's conclusion, whether or not it's the sole source of their conclusion.
And there's no question. He came back with the conclusion to Cheney's question that it is highly doubtful that such a transaction took place.
And the CIA endorsed that and tried, and because of that endorsement, tried to get the reference taken out of the State of the Union speech.
The president made no reference to a transaction having taken place. His reference was to Saddam Hussein seeking uranium, which is different from acquiring it.
David Korn, I want to come back to you with our caller's question, which is a great one, and you can take it where you will. But first, to this issue of the forged letters indicating a transaction between Niger and Iraq, who would have had an interest in forging such letters?
Anybody who wanted to see us go to war, maybe someone was trying to make a buck by selling something to an intelligence agency. But, you know, that should be investigated. The CIA should get to the bottom of it. I don't know why they haven't after, you know, it's been well over a year now, and they can't prove that. But I take strong exception to what Cliff says about Joe Wilson. He is mischaracterizing what he did. He sat around drinking tea for 8 days.
That's what Joe said he did. He said
that in his piece. He also described all the different people he spoke to.
He did interviews at the embassy.
Let me finish.
That's all he did.
You let me finish. He described how he reached his conclusions on the basis of who he spoke to, and this is the fellow who was who served the first Bush administration. He served he served Bill Clinton as well. He was considered a hero by the first set of hostages for getting them out of Iraq. He supported the first war, the first Gulf War. This, he is an ambassador. He knew who to talk to in town, and he came back, and you know what? He was right. It turns out those documents, which got triggered this whole thing to begin with, were forged, and he came back and said this doesn't make sense, and it's based on how the Iranian ministry is structured there, and I don't see it.
I guess the proof is in the pudding there in some degree, because the CIA seemed to have accepted his view. But we've got more callers. I want to get to them. David's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good evening. Quite timely to take my call,
considering
bringing up the intelligence question.
Yeah.
And let's all remember, too, that every embassy around the world has an intelligence desk.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I'm sure that there are individuals that Mr. Wilson spoke to that he probably chose to not name. But, I mean, to say he just drank tea and talked to a few locals and found out there was no yellow cake uranium.
Well, we don't want to get lost in that, but the CIA ended up taking his view. But what's your larger point, David?
My larger point is, and I'm curious, and it's obviously coming to a head, because what disturbs me as a conservative is I see conservatives turning on conservatives now, those who want the truth and those who are attempting to hide it. And I'm curious as to whether your guests see a coming. If the Democrats are smart, they'll sit back and let the intelligence community and the administration battle this out, because this is what I see coming to a head right now. What you're going to see is you're going to see Tenet's head on a pike. I think he will fall on the sword for this, but I think that the broader intelligence community is going to feel slighted, for lack of a better word.
Well, there's been a lot of grumbling so far, the sense that they were strong-armed, at least from some quarters, the complaint that they were strong-armed to support a particular point of view, a particular agenda. On the other hand, George Tenet stood up today, and he said, this line in the speech was mine. I take full responsibility for it. The president was not...
I think he'll fall on the sword, but I think the broader intelligence community, I think they've been taking a beating in the press, and they've certainly been taking a beating by your guest as well, and I think they're going to fight back on this.
And John McCain, to your comment about conservatives, John McCain was on the record today saying we should track down what went on here, and if somebody gave bad information, they should lose their job.
Well, in the effort of full disclosure, I did vote for John McCain. So.
We won't discount you as a citizen on that basis, David. Right. Thank you for your call. Clifford May, what about you? You've heard the very unhappy rumbling from some quarters of the intelligence community about the whole run-up to the war and how things unfolded. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it gets back to also what the earlier caller was saying. Do we have a problem with our intelligence gathering capabilities? And the answer is that we do. It's not nearly where it should be in a time of global conflict. It has been diminished over the past 10 or 15 or even more years.
But that's not their complaint. Their complaint is that the intelligence that was gathered was then ignored or juiced up.
It is. I can't quite address it the way you're putting it, because I disagree with the premise. It is possible that President Bush believed British intelligence over the CIA on whether or not Saddam Hussein was seeking uranium from Africa, although I have no information, I don't think you or David do, that the CIA has ever said, no, we know Saddam wasn't seeking. They just couldn't verify for sure where and when, and they didn't have the information, and the one transaction that they had information on turned out to be false. I think at a certain point, Bush may have said, I think Tony Blair knows what he's talking about, and British intelligence knows what he's talking about, and I'm really concerned that Saddam is going to get some of that uranium, and then it's too late for us.
Clifford May, our time is running down. Briefly, where do you think this is headed? You talk about, in your piece, you know, this being treated as another Watergate, this being put forward as grounds for impeachment. Is that where we're going here or not?
Well, that's where some Democrats are going, not all. I think if they does go in that direction, it's a mistake for Democrats as well as for Republicans. Right now, Democrats are seen as not being as trustworthy on matters of national security and the war on terrorism as Republicans. When people hear it with the argument that David is making, they're going to think, Democrats wouldn't go to war against Saddam Hussein. They would wait until the threat matures, until they see the smoke coming out of the gun.
Let me put it to David Korn at that point. We've got it, Clifford May. David Korn, your view, where is this headed?
I don't know. I don't care about the politics of this.
Well, you don't? I mean, impeachment is one of the things that Clifford May raised. That seems consequential.
I don't care about impeachment. I care about finding the truth first. And, you know, and people can worry about consequences if it's proven beyond doubt that the president knowingly lied about this, that, or the other thing, or misrepresented intelligence. Several intelligence analysts have already come forward, have already testified before the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, saying that they were pressured to rig their intelligence to fit White House policy. And, you know, it's not new. They said this to the L.A. Times, to the USA Today, and Washington Post last fall.
This
has been going on for a long time, and someone needs to get to the bottom of this, because the administration should be held accountable whether the war was a jolly good thing or a terrible thing. The fact that Bush might not have told the truth as he took the nation to war and occupation is what I think is paramount now that needs to be examined.
David Korn, we've got it. And with that, we're out of time. Clifford May, David Korn, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
David Korn is with The Nation magazine. Clifford May, president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, one doctor's reaction to the Senate's rejection of medical malpractice legislation. This is On Point. Yesterday, the U.S. Senate voted down medical malpractice legislation that would have capped pain and suffering damages at $250,000 per case. The bill's proponents had argued that without the cap, the high cost of malpractice insurance will force doctors and clinics out of business. Opponents argued that capping malpractice damages would leave doctors unaccountable for medical errors. Dr. Gregory Sirocco is a surgeon in Wheeling, West Virginia. In January, he and over a dozen of his colleagues took leaves of absence to protest high malpractice insurance costs. The job action effectively shut down Wheeling Hospital and launched the malpractice issue into the national spotlight. West Virginia has since passed its own version of malpractice reform that took effect last week. In this radio diary, Dr. Sirocco laments the Senate's failure to pass the medical malpractice bill.
I was certainly dismayed. We need federal tort reform because the states can't or won't seem to be able to do it on their own. Physicians across the country are in a malpractice crisis. My malpractice insurance 10 years ago as a general surgeon was probably somewhere around $25,000 to $30,000 a year. Last year, it cost me approximately $90,000. And the reason for that is that there was so much litigation going on in the state of West Virginia that nobody would want to continue to write malpractice insurance in this state. It's a nationwide problem. There are many physicians across the country lost their insurance, so it's affecting everybody. It's to the point where you couldn't afford to practice medicine, which is why 18 surgeons in the northern panhandle of West Virginia took leave of absences from their jobs on January 1st this year so that we could look for employment elsewhere. Prior to that drastic action, nobody in our state would admit that we had a crisis. Nobody would talk to us. We tried to talk to the governor for 3 or 4 months before we took that drastic action. Nobody would talk to us. So we felt that there was nothing left for us to do but to stop practicing. And once that happened, we certainly got the attention of our legislature. And in fact, we got the attention of the whole nation. We had physicians calling us from across the country wanting to know how much money it would take to keep us out. It was mind-boggling to see the attention that this got. Our legislators, of course, will say that our leaves of absence had nothing to do with the tort reform that was passed, but I feel otherwise. I agree that there has to be accountability in the system, but it's awfully difficult to put a price on pain and suffering. And, you know, we see juries come back with outrageous awards of $5, $6, $7 million for pain and suffering. We're not talking about economic damages here. Certainly anybody that has been harmed should be able to seek redress in the courts to pay their economic damages, but it's difficult to put a price on pain and suffering, and it's out of hand. I mean, we see this not only in medical malpractice, but all forms of civil litigation. The lady that spilled hot coffee on herself got a multi-million dollar award for pain and suffering. We've got people suing McDonald's now because they got fat eating McDonald's food. That's clearly out of hand. And it's affecting everything. And it's not just medical malpractice insurance. The state of West Virginia, right now, residents are having a hard time getting homeowners insurance, hard time getting car insurance. So there has to be liability reform across the board. It shouldn't just be with medical malpractice.
Dr. Gregory Sirocco is a surgeon at Wheeling Hospital and Ohio Valley Medical Center in Wheeling, West Virginia. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Julie Jupp and John Parati. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point.